This is episode 461 of Wheel Bearings. I am Sam Abuel Samad from Telemetry.
And I am Roberto Baldwin from SAE International.
And Nicole's not here this week. I can't remember where she said
she's probably doing something cool.
Yeah.
Cooler
than sitting around on a Sunday morning with the two of us.
Cookie or Disney related. That's why I feel like that's if Nicole's not here, that's what she's doing.
All right. Well, speaking of sweet stuff, I've been getting into making ice cream in recent weeks because it's been hot here.
Mm-hmm.
And I made this amazing chocolate sorbet yesterday.
Wow.
Really good.
That's nice.
But anyway.
I'm not really a big fan of chocolate.
Yeah.
Just another reason why I'm an odd person.
I also have a great strawberry ice cream that I made.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Next week, I think I might make some strawberry sorbet. We'll see.
Ooh.
So what have you been driving?
So this week after last week, last week I had the Explorer Tremor, and I was just like, I don't know what that car's for. This week I got the Chevy Trax LT, and you know exactly who this car is for. Like you need an inexpensive little SUV that has apparently enough room for two guitar amps, two guitars, some percussion, a monitor, some other random stuff. Oh, also a keyboard at the same time. Like you could put a lot of stuff in the back of this little car. Put the seats down, go do your band stuff. That's what I've learned about the Chevy Trax.
It's for somebody in a band who doesn't get paid very much for being in a band.
Which is everyone. No one's making money in the band. We all, we have to pay. Everyone got $100 from a gig, and then you go out and buy like a $400 guitar.
Yeah, that math works about right.
Well, we played 7 gigs, and now I'm going to buy a $2,000 keyboard. Like, all right. And then, of course, we have a space, which we have to pay rent on, which, that's like $80 a month per person. Yeah, no one makes money usually in a band. Anywho, Chevy Trax is for the person in the band who's, you don't have a lot of money. I will say, unlike the Chevy, the Explorer, it has a wireless charger. I still don't understand why that Explorer didn't have a wireless charger. But this one does, and it's wireless, Apple Android. Yes, sorry. I had the show last night, so I'm very tired and a little loopy. It has wireless Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. I could not for the life of me figure out last night on my way home from the club how to find it, what my miles per gallon was. I just kept hitting buttons, and I was like, I give up. But according to the EPA, they get 30 miles per gallon combined, 28 city, 32 highway, which is pretty good, for a small little car. You need to get around. Gas is very expensive. It's not cheap. 30 miles per gallon is pretty good for, a non-hybrid vehicle. I get it. Now my nose is a little runny as well. Overall, it feels like an inexpensive Chevy product. You get in, you're like, yeah, that's exactly what this is. It's an inexpensive Chevy product. And, the starting price for this one was, $23,000 for the one LT. I'm sorry. I didn't know what the one is for. That's one
that's
limited.
To distinguish it from the two LT.
I guess.
Which is, one more.
One more. It's a little
it's,
bit.
It's an extra. It's one more LT.
It's one more LT. It has the Ecotec 1.2 liter turbo. Ooh. Which sounds eco. It's, 30 miles per gallon is like, yeah, sure. Tech, if you say so. And then turbo, sure. It's not a quick vehicle. It's not supposed to be. I think I think as automotive journalists, we tend to start expecting everything to be a performance vehicle. Not everything needs to be a performance vehicle. Sometimes you just need to get around. So this is definitely I just need to get around. It's got a, 6-speed transmission, automatic transmission. And, there's some times where you're just like, what is the transmission doing? What's happening here? You're like, come on. And again, inexpensive car, $20,000. A lot of the little things are just like, well, there's this, but like, yeah, but it's only, let's look at the. I didn't even look up the starting price of this vehicle, so it shows you where I'm at this morning, and it is $21,700 according to Chevy. So it's for what it is. You're like, yeah, all right, sure, okay. It does the thing it needs to do. It's not fancy in any way at all. It is but the biggest problem with the Chevy Trax is that it exists in the world with the Hyundai Venue, which to me feels like a nicer vehicle, and it's actually a little bit cheaper. It's a couple hundred bucks cheaper, almost $1,000 cheaper. But the Venue is a little bit, I believe the Venue is a little bit smaller.
The back seat.
Yeah, the back seat's pretty tight. You know, the Trax is, it's okay for the back seat. You know, I'm not going to be hanging out back there if I can help it. But you put those rear seats down, you got a little extra space. It has a knob for the volume. It also has knobs for climate control, which I am a big fan of, versus the push a button up, push a button down, or worse on screen, push a button up, push a button down. I like turning, like hotter right, colder left, hotter right. And my BRZ has that. The Chevy Trax has that. And I'm like, this is so much nicer than what's in, say, the Hummer. So yeah, a big fan of that. Overall, yeah, the Chevy Trax, you need an inexpensive vehicle. You need, you know, a little bit more space. You don't really care about performance, because this car is not there. I don't think Chevy even tells us a 0-60.
You know, I think you can say the same thing, you know, about most entry level vehicles. You know, pretty much all entry level vehicles.
Yeah.
None of them are particularly performant, but they're adequate. And especially, you know, if you're like me, you know, old enough to remember when cheap cars, you know, were genuinely slow, you know.
Oh, yeah.
These cars they're not slow. You know, I mean, they all get to 0-60 in like under 8-ish seconds, you know, around eight seconds or so, which is way more than adequate. I remember, you know, when a cheap car, you know, an entry level car, you would be lucky to get to 60 miles an hour in 20 seconds.
It's just like,
and, you know, if you ever drove an old air cooled Beetle, ooh, yeah.
Oh,
it
yeah,
might get to 60 miles an hour eventually.
They air cooled Beetles. It's like a couple days. Like,
yeah.
Downhill with the tailwind. Like, where are you going?
What's
your rush? What do you? I remember my 90 Honda Civic DX hatchback had like 86 horsepower.
Yeah,
but it had a manual transmission, so I just, you know, rolled the hell out of it while getting up there. But also, I was like, whatever. I got where I was going. I didn't, you know. Chevy Trax. You need to get around. Cool, you know, it's, you know, check, you know, you're gonna check it if it gets the kicks, which is like, I love the kicks. HRV is a good, you know, vehicle, but yeah, you know, the Trax, inexpensive, you need to get where you're going. Hey, high five, you got there. If you're in a band, perfect vehicle. If you're a band, you're not making a lot of money, perfect vehicle. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, if you got, you know, young drivers in your family, you know, and you want to buy them something new that's got, you know, some ADAS features on it, you know, it's not so fast that it's likely to get them into a lot of trouble, you know, but it can, you know, get them to school or whatever, you know, if you're sending off your kid to college, you know, for the freshman year this fall, and you want to get them a new car, you know, something like this is great, you know, and it's, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, we've raised the bar on what is entry level. It used to be, you know, I mean, I can remember when it was, you know, $10,000 and then $15,000 and then 20, you know, now it's 25 is, you know, kind of the entry point. You know, if you can get stuff under 25, and there's a handful of decent vehicles that you can get for under 25 grand. And this, you know, this is one of them.
Yeah. There's some, you know, there's some good little cars out there. Again, I talked about the Venue. I mean, the kicks. I love the kicks. I love a nice, inexpensive car, because I think it's really, really hard to make a good, inexpensive car. It's not that hard to make a really good luxury car, because you can just keep cramming things on there to make it luxury and just keep raising the price. Now, whether or not people buy it or not is a whole other issue. But like to make a good, inexpensive car that you can make money off of, which is, you know, the profit margins are slimmer on an inexpensive vehicle. So, you know, if an automaker can, make an inexpensive car, then no one buys it. They're like, oh, well, we tried. And then they just like, all you get is mid-level.
If
you make a good and expensive car, what that means is that person buys that, maybe it's their first car, maybe their parents buy it, maybe they buy it. And then, you hope that that translates to brand loyalty. I mean, my first car was a Datsun Roadster, so that doesn't really count. But, second car was a Honda Civic, and I love that. Then I got a Del Sol, and we got a CRV, and then, once I got my Subaru, now my WRX, and I got a BRZ, and then we got the Hyundai, the Hyundai electric vehicles. It's just three Hyundais in a row. So it's kind of like, oh, these are really nice. I enjoy these. I'm going to keep buying them. And that's sort of what the automakers want. And for the individuals that, that want an inexpensive car, whether it's their second car, their main car, because they really don't care about going fast or all the stuff that the bells and whistles, and this has a lot of bells and whistles for the price, then yeah, you're good to go. I will say there was one thing that was like, I was driving, I'm like, well, this seems not great. Was I could put it in cruise control, but to put it in adaptive cruise control, I had to push another button, and so it was telling me that, but like the thing would pop up just long enough for me to notice it was there, and I'd look at it, it'd go away.
Noticed that on some GM cars, that interface that they have between toggling between regular cruise and adaptive cruise is kind of weird.
It's ridiculous because it gives you yellow letter, a yellow like wording or text that pops up in the dash cluster, and by the time you look down, you're like, wait, what's going on? What do I have to do? That it's gone. You're like, okay, hold on. So then you got to keep doing it, and now I'm not watching the road at all. I'm like, well, this is not great at all. So I would say figure that, read the book or something before that, because it is, I think you have to push the cruise control, then push the turn off cruise control to put adaptive cruise, like hold turn off cruise control to turn on adaptive cruise control is if I remember correctly. And then adaptive cruise control comes on, because you just put on cruise control, you're just going to slam into the back of somebody. And I was just like, oh my God, this is not ideal. This is actually unsafe. So that's my big, big, like, what are you doing over there? What's happening? So yeah, Chevy, the Trax.
Good basic transportation.
Do you want to guess what the destination fee was?
Let's see. I'm gonna guess $1,450.
$1,795.
Ooh,
for the Trax. What are we doing?
It does come from. It is built in Korea, so they got to ship it a little bit farther.
But I guess, yeah. That's the other thing. I think people will buy this and they'll be like, oh, cool.
GM is probably hiding some of the extra tariff cost in that increased destination fee too.
Yeah, they move all that stuff around, and they sort of spread it out amongst all the vehicles and stuff. So yeah, Chevy Trax isn't a jet black with blue accents. It was a nice little color.
Nice.
Or no, sorry, the interior was jet black. The exterior is mosaic black metallic.
Oh, okay.
It was nice. It looked
Does good. It look like it's made up of a bunch of little pieces all kind of glued together?
Yeah, it's all like, it's just like little tiles. They just broke them and glued them on there. Yeah, Chevy Trax. Yeah. If you're looking for a cheap car for yourself, your kids, whatever, cross shop it with some other ones. I still think the Venue is probably the Kicks. I don't know. I like the Kicks a lot. I think, Nissan makes a really good, inexpensive car.
Yeah, they do. Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. We've updated the Wheel Bearings merch store, and now there's a whole bunch of new choices, new colors, new styles, T-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, hats, mugs, travel mugs, stickers, aprons, tote bags, you name it. You can get your Wheel Bearings merch at shop.wheelbearings.media. Go check it out. That's shop.wheelbearings.media. All right. Well, I had actually had two different vehicles this week. I had another Maverick. So a couple weeks ago, I had the Maverick Lobo, which I thought was way too expensive for what it is. This time, I had a Maverick XLT hybrid with all-wheel drive. So last year, when they did the refresh of the Maverick, the mid-cycle refresh, they added an all-wheel drive hybrid option, because when it first came out, my next door neighbors, you know, they have a Maverick, they got an XL, but for the first three years of production, the hybrid was only available with front wheel drive. You couldn't get it with all wheel drive. So if you lived somewhere where you had, you know, bad weather conditions and you wanted that extra bit of traction, you know, you'd have to go with the two liter turbo EcoBoost engine. Now you can get the hybrid with all-wheel drive. And it was always kind of strange that they did that, because, you know, this is based on the same platform as the Bronco Sport and the Escape, which is now out of production. The Escape always had a hybrid all-wheel drive variant available. So they had the hardware. Why they didn't put it in the Maverick at first, I don't know. But at any rate, the Maverick XLT hybrid that I had was... It was finished in this light blue color that looks more baby blue. it's a real pale blue color. You know, it looks fine. You know, I like the darker blue on my neighbor's Maverick, but you know, that's whatever. You know, whatever. I'm just glad they've got some interesting colors. And the problem with this one, you know, it's still. You know, the Maverick, you know, when they designed it, they, you know, it's all, you know, to keep the cost down, it's all hard plastics inside. There's no really, you know, not much in the way of soft touch materials, which I'm fine with on a less expensive car. And that worked fine when the Maverick started at $20,000, or you could get, you know, nicely equipped one for $25,000. You know, and they did a nice job with the texturing of the plastic, so it doesn't really look super cheap. It's not like the old days, you know, when you would get like a Chevy Cobalt that, you know, it was all like smooth, grainless plastic that genuinely looked cheap. You know, this is not like that. You know, so it looks decent, and you know, it still has all the features you had in the Maverick since the beginning, with the kind of little slightly odd armrests in the doors with the cutout, so you had a space where if you have an extra tall water bottle, you could drop it down in there because you had that gap in there in the armrest. Cool idea. But when you start adding up the price, you know, basically for the hybrid now, you're starting at about $29,000 or almost, it's about $30,000 for the XLT, which is the mid-level trim going up. You know, it starts at XL, XLT. And then you add on the all-wheel drive, you add on some other options. Like this one had spray and bed liner. It had, the Copilot 360 ADAS package. It had a hard trifold tonneau cover on it, same as the one that was on the Lobo that I had. And all of a sudden this thing came out to a grand total of, where's the page there? Grand total, $38,655.
I've seen a couple articles where people are like, you know, if you put a lot of options on the slate, it costs a lot of money. I'm like, yeah, that's how cars work.
Yeah.
But I still, you know, I think that our issue with the Maverick was it came out as a very, you know, as an inexpensive entry level vehicle at like, you know, $20,000, $21,000, and then it went up like 40%, and then but nothing really, but like all the bits
without anything really changing.
Yeah, you're just like, haha. Like, what?
The only thing that really changed on that base XL model that was $20,000, is now, you know, 28 and a half, is they made cruise control standard equipment. That was the one thing that my neighbors were annoyed at when they got theirs and they realized, oh, this doesn't have cruise control on it. And, you know, Randy got an aftermarket cruise control switch, you know, that he got a mechanic to wire in for him. It was like $300.
Yeah.
So no big deal. So it was $20,300. You know, the cruise control is standard now across the board, but it starts at, you know, over $28,000. And,
yeah,
you know, this one, you know, the all wheel drive starts at over $30,000. And then by the time you add in, you know, a handful of options, you know, at almost $39,000, this is still, you know, it still feels like a $20,000 Maverick, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that's, you know, and I don't know. I mean, the price isn't going to go back down. That's the worst part. I think, you know, a couple people in my neighborhood bought Mavericks back when they weren't, you know, more. And, you know, it's a great, you know, at the price and what it was and what it is, it's a great little truck. And then, you know, Ford saw that a lot of people are buying it. They're like, oh, well, let's just charge more. And I don't know what the numbers are. I haven't bothered to look up their sales numbers. I mean, if they're selling them, then
it's still selling really well. I mean, I think they sold like 170,000 last year, almost 180,000 of them. So
they're
still
doing fine.
Yeah. And just last quarter, you know, they sold 48,000, 49,000, you know, in the second quarter of 2026. So it's still selling.
Oh, yeah.
But
so, yeah, still people still want a small truck. I mean, you know, for years, people would come up to me like, I would like a small truck. When's it, like, I'm in charge of the automakers. People, you tell them you're an automaker or an automotive journalist, like, you know, what happened to small trucks? And I'm like, they don't, you know, no one wants to make them because, you know, they have to, you know, there's regulatory stuff they have to deal with because they're smaller. The profit margins are slimmer. And then Ford and was like, yeah, I guess we'll try this. And then it went off like gangbusters, like, oh, you know what? Let's just raise the price.
Well, you know, I mean, if you remember, you know, a couple of years back, you know, when the Maverick first came out, you know, this was around the time that you had the chip shortages and everything else. And a lot of dealers were charging insane markups on cars.
Oh,
and,
man.
You know, and the Maverick was one of those cars that was getting really big markups. And I remember there was a listener that wrote into us, you know, complaining, I think somewhere in Virginia, you know, he had ordered a Maverick and it finally came in, you know, it took like 6 months or something, you know, to finally show up. And then, you know, the dealer said, you know, he got a notification from the dealer, your truck's in, come on in, get it. Called to make an appointment to go pick it up. And when he got there, he said, oh, no, we sold it. You know, and, you know, they apparently sold it for quite a bit more than the price that he had agreed to pay for it.
It's funny because I feel like, you know, I have a friend who bought it, who ordered a Bronco when it came in. They're like, oh, by the way, now you owe us $7,000 more now.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Ford, like, it feels like almost faux, like, outrage because they just looked at that and looked at those numbers. They're like, you know what? We can just charge more for these vehicles.
Well, and I think that's what Ford did with the Maverick. They were seeing dealers charging $5,000 to $10,000 over sticker for these things. They said, we'll take that. We'll take that money. And they just raised the MSRP. And it got to the point, you know, when you raise the MSRP enough, the dealers couldn't get away with charging that much of a markup. So customers were paying the same amount, except it was going to Ford instead of the dealers.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, womp.
Yeah. You want to take a guess at the destination charge?
Oh, gosh. 18?
Close. 1845. That's another one that's gone up a lot in the last year.
Much money.
Yeah.
No, it's, every once in a while, you know, I understand, you know, the Maverick starts, if it was a $20,000 vehicle, let's say you take $8,000 off the price, you know, the Lobo or whatever. And so instead of being like 38, it'd be 32. And you're like, fine. That's how cars work. Whenever you add, you know, options, the more things you add to it, the more the car's going to cost. that's how the whole system works. But I love the faux outrage of like, you know, if you add every option to the Slate truck.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing? You're an automotive site. Come on, you know how this works. Those are just hate clicks you're looking for. You're doing clickbait. Come on. We option, you know. Or a smarter way is like, hey, if you spend all, I do love it when people are like, we put everything on and now the 911 costs $300,000. Look at all the cool things you can add to it. Instead, it's more like, can you believe how much money you have to pay extra if you add things to this vehicle? I'm just like,
that's the way it has always been.
That's kind of, yeah, that's the way it goes.
You know, and I think, you know, what annoys me more is just, you know, the increase in the base price. I don't have an issue with, you know,
You buy iterations,
you pay extra for those. But
yeah. Yeah, the increase in the base price is just, it just feels like, again, really like the Maverick. I really like that it's, you know, they were, you know, Ford was very, Ford embraced like the 3D printing community and sort of the, you know, the sort of the maker. They didn't do a very good job. They never, as far as I can tell, they never put like the 3D files out. The community had to come up with stuff because yeah. When I had the Maverick, I did a video about how it's a great truck for nerds. And I kept trying to get Ford to send me the 3D files. And I ended up just using files that the community had created. And then the files that Ford sent me were like, it was the opposite of what I needed.
Yeah.
instead of having like, let's say you have a hand in glove. Instead of giving me the file for the glove so I could put things put things in the glove, they gave me the glove itself. I'm like, well, that's the opposite. I need the other part. I was like, I think you guys really embraced it. And then you were like, didn't carry, you know, as far as I know, that's where you have to get the files from, is the community. So you can still 3D print stuff. I 3D printed a bunch of stuff for it, and then my neighbor's like son-in-law bought a Maverick, so I just gave them all to him.
There you go. Yeah. On the plus side, you know, even with the all-wheel drive added on, you know, and the extra weight of the hard tonneau cover and things like that, this thing is still really, really fuel efficient as a hybrid. You know, I think the Lobo I had, if I recall, you know, was getting like 25 miles per gallon. This thing on my efficiency loop got 40.5 miles per gallon.
Wow.
You know, and that's with air conditioning running because it was hot out, hot and humid out. So I had the AC running and, you know, almost 41 miles per gallon with this little truck.
That's nice.
Yeah. So, you know, it's still, you know, it's going to save, you know, if you're looking for something really efficient, you know, that will carry four people and has, you know, a decent amount of space. I mean, you can easily fit, you know, a dozen bags of mulch in the back of this thing.
Oh yeah. I stuck like almost 1,000 pounds of rocks in the back of the Maverick when I had it.
Yeah. Like, well, and the picture that I had, you know, with the Lobo with, you know, all the old decking material that I had loaded in the back of that thing. Let's see. Oh, here we go.
Yeah.
There it is. Yeah. So, you know, that one, you know, so you can put a lot of stuff in the back of this thing.
Yeah. No, it's, again, I think we all like the Maverick. We're just sad that Ford sort of like, ha ha.
It got too expensive.
Yeah. It's almost like, so anyway.
All right. So the other one that I had was the new Subaru Uncharted GT. So the Uncharted is, you know, the third model in Subaru's EV lineup. It's based on the same architecture as the Solterra and the Trail Seeker and the Toyota BZ and BZ Woodland and CHR. And in fact, you know, this is essentially a rebadged version of the CHR. You know, it's got the different front fascia that has the new Subaru headlight design with the six element LED lights in the front, you know, echoing the six stars in the Subaru logo. And you know, it's shorter. It's about 6.5 inches shorter than a Solterra, has a fastback design. So it's a little sportier looking. So if you, you know, if you need, you know, if you're looking for something like the Solterra, but you want something a, a little, you know, a little more fun looking. They, the Uncharted's got you covered. You know, it, here we go. Yeah. So you can see the headlights here if you're watching the video. And the door handles, you know, on the front doors, it's got no electromechanical door handles. They're mechanical.
Yay.
So you got conventional ones on the front doors, on the back doors, the rear door handles are kind of hidden in the C pillar, but it's still a mechanical door handle. It's easy to grab, to pull open. So, you know, it works well. There's a decent amount of room inside, even though, like I said, 6.5 inches shorter, has about 3.5 to 4 inch shorter wheelbase than the Solterra. It actually still has a decent amount of rear seat leg room. So, you know, again, if you're watching the video, this shows you the rear seat with the front, with the driver's seat positioned for me. You know, I'm about 5'11", and I still had plenty of head and leg room in this thing. I had a couple inches to spare for my knees. I had headroom clearance, so no problem at all there. So there's plenty of room inside this thing. There's good cargo space in the back. One of the things that was nice to see on so they have three trim levels. They have premium, which for Subaru is their base trim level on most of their models.
I love that. Yeah, it's all of the base levels. Premium. You're like, that's not how words work.
And then sport, and then GT is the top trim. So the premium is the only one of the Subaru EVs. Actually, I think it's the only Subaru currently offered in North America that is front wheel drive. So it's a single motor front drive. That one starts at $35,000. It's 221 horsepower. You got 74.7 kilowatt hour battery. It's about 307 or 8 miles of range. You know, it has a decent amount of cargo space in behind, as well, even with the fastback design. And then the Sport and the GT are both dual motor all-wheel drive, 338 horsepower. The Sport has 18-inch wheels. The GT gets you 20-inch wheels and a little bit more, a few other options that aren't on the Sport. One of the features that was in this one is there's an outlet in the rear cargo area, it's a 1500 watt, 120 volt AC outlet.
Cool.
So basically it's a vehicle to load, but unlike with the Hyundais and Kias, you know, where you have to use an adapter plugged into the charge port, this just gives you the outlet straight in the back. So you don't have to mess around with any adapters.
They have one in the highest trims for the Hyundais and Kias. That's like between the seat. It's almost like an airline.
Yeah, it's in the passenger area.
Yeah, yeah.
So this one is in the cargo area.
Which actually is kind of, I think it's better, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because you're going to, like, if you, especially, if, you know, you're a Subaru owner, so you're out doing adventure things. And so you're like hanging out outside your truck and you want to, or your truck. You're hanging out, again, I'm very tired, hanging outside your vehicle and you plug in your, I don't know, margarita machine, whatever you do when you're out with your
coffee
Subaru.
Maker.
Coffee maker.
You take your coffee maker. Or you take your microwave with you on a camping trip.
Yeah. Make some hot pockets.
Yeah, there you go. Some hot pockets and some popcorn.
Yeah. What are you going to get? Hot pockets.
So yeah, you got a 1500 watt outlet in the back. Just, you know, plug in whatever you need to back there. So that's very handy. I took it on my same range test I did with the Maverick and with pretty much all the other vehicles I drive. And it averaged 4 miles per kilowatt hour. So,
wow, because I did the math and it was like 3.8.
Yeah.
Just now, 4 miles. That's some great. Again, that's, you know, the Subaru and it's Toyota, you know, like you said, and Toyota just like come out fighting with their efficiency, which is outstanding.
Yeah, no, it's really good. The range on the GT, the official range on the GT is 273 miles, which, like you said, I think is about 3.7 or 3.8 miles per kilowatt hour. I got 4 miles per kilowatt hour. And I wasn't really babying it. It was just driving it normally. had the AC on because, again, it's hot this week. You know, that works out to just, you know, like 299 miles of range. So, you know, you're going to get, you know, in like obviously in winter, you're going to get a little bit less. But, you know, in most normal driving conditions, you're going to get roughly around 300 miles, probably somewhere between 290, 310 miles of range, even with the GT trim. And the GT has, or actually all of them, all of the Uncharteds, have, two wireless charging pads. So, you know, when they redid the Solterra last year, they got the same interior in this one here. Got 14-inch center touchscreen as standard, 7-inch, instrument cluster display in front of the driver. The Solterra and the Uncharted get sort of a squared off steering wheel, flat top, flat bottom, round sides. But you know, that squared, that flattened top part gives you clear access or clear visibility to the instrument cluster display, which is pushed right up to the base of the windshield. So it's almost like having a heads up display. But now it's no longer blocked by, you know, half blocked by the steering wheel like it was in the original Solterra. You got two wireless charging pads below the 14-inch infotainment screen. You know, it's very handy, very convenient. It drives really well. You know, I was really impressed by how well it drives now. So it's, you know, it's a really nice EV. So even if you get the base premium model, you know, you're going to have over 300 miles of range. It's got a J3400 charging port that is on the right front fender, the passenger side front fender. I took it over to the supercharger station, nosed into the charging bay, and even with those short little cables that Tesla insists on using, I was able to plug it in, no problem at all.
Bam.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had the Outback? Yeah, I had the Outback. It has the same sort of charging situation. It's fine with the flat, you know, it's wireless charging. But if you do Subaru things with your Subaru, since your wireless charging just kind of plops, you know, your phone just bopping all over the place. I will say with the Trax, it's like a little channel that like dives into the dash, and you can slide your phone in there, and it's at an angle, so it can't like pop out. So I did like that. So.
Yeah, this one, they've got ridges. There's like a divider between the two charging pads, so it kind of keeps the phone from moving around very much. So that's handy.
Yeah, for most of your driving, you'll be fine. You know, when you go do the, you know, you can shove it underneath in that little cubby so it doesn't pop out. But someone has one where you slide it in.
Cadillac.
Cadillac.
Like yeah.
Yeah. I really like the Cadillac one. And then you can't look at your phone at all because it's slid into a slot. You can't even, which I think is a bonus, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because
understand. Temptation to look at it.
Yeah. You don't have that temptation. So, yeah. Yeah. I'm supposed to get the Trail Seeker soon. So I'm looking forward to that.
So the Trail Seeker's got more power. It's got 375 horsepower. Versus the 338, but even, you know, the 338 is plenty. It'll do 0-60 in about 4.5 seconds. The base single motor version, it's about 6.5 seconds, 0-60, plenty quick enough. And because it's an EV, you've got that instant responsiveness right off the line. So it feels quicker than it is. So it's, you know, it's really nice to drive. The ride quality is good. You know, I haven't done any off-roading with this thing, but, when I did the drive program for the Solterra last year, you know, they took us on a pretty, you know, pretty decent off-road trail. And, you know, some of the roads that we were on were actually more aggressive than, you know, in terms of the rocks and stuff. You know, we were out in Colorado. Mm-hmm. So we were on some unpaved roads that were pretty challenging. And it, you know, it had no problem at all. And that car doesn't even have all-terrain tires on it, and neither does this one. The Trail Seeker and the BZ Woodland have all-terrain tires. These are just basic all-season tires, and it does great. The X-Mode traction control works really well. So, And, you know, 8.4 inches of ground clearance compared to the Ioniq 5 XRT Pro, XRT is only 7 inches. And the Mach-E Rally is only 6 inches of ground clearance. So, you know, you got a decent amount. You know, it's not, you know, you're not going to be, you know, doing anything like driving around Moab or going to the Rubicon Trail with this. But, you know, it's going to handle, you know, any, you know, typical trail that most people are going to use.
It's an appropriate amount of ground clearance for what for what 90% of people are doing, especially Subaru people, because they Subaru be like, I got to go through the snow. I got to do, a dirt road.
You're not going to get it beached in the snow.
Yeah, you know, I think super of all the people who when they go out and buy their all, you know, their sort of outdoor adventure car, I think Subaru people are more likely to actually do the outdoor adventure thing. Like, I just need something to put my bike on, to put my kayak, to do the thing. Like, you buy a Subaru, they give you a dog, and then like something to do with your body.
Yeah.
Like, what do you want? Did you want the bike? Do you want the kayak? What do you want? What do you want? What do you want? Wait, surfboard?
Oh, you want both? No problem. I'll put a roof rack on for your kayak. And
here's your golden retriever. See you later.
Go inside. And then you can, I think you can get a hitch on here to put a hitch-mounted bike rack on there.
Oh, yeah.
So you have your bike on the back, your kayak on the roof, and your dog in the back seat. All good.
You're living a Subaru lifestyle. I'll tell you, the most active I've ever been was when I had my Subaru WRX. I was surfing, I was snowboarding, I was doing all the things.
So, like I said, the premium, the base premium, starts at $35,000. The one I had, which was, and the other thing I like about this car, the color. I mean, it's mostly boring colors, but they've got a couple of cool colors, like this Habanero orange metallic, and it got the two-tone. So the grand total came to $46,215. You want to guess at the destination?
16.
1450.
Ooh. I shouldn't be, like, excited about that. That's still too high, to be honest.
$970 for the two-tone paint. And then, you know, the base price on the GT is $43,795. So, if you're looking for an EV that, you know, is kind of fun, very practical, has plenty of good features. You know, they, like I said, like they did with the Solterra and the BZ last year, you know, this has huge number of improvements. It's way more efficient than the original Solterra and BZ4X were. The charging is a lot better. It's still only 150 kilowatts, but, you know, you can go from 10 to 80% in about 28 minutes on a suitable charger. And you got the NACS charging port, so it works with most of the supercharger stations, as well as, you know, the other chargers, you know, that are the other companies that are increasingly putting NACS connectors on their chargers, like Walmart and Ayana are, you know, they're all dual connectors, CCS and NACS. EVgo is starting to deploy, you know, putting them on a bunch of theirs now. And it also comes with two charging adapters. So you get a CCS to NACS and a 1772 to NACS charging adapters that come with the car. So,
it's very weird now that you can get it. Like, I think the Bolt, you have to like buy the connectors with when you get the Bolt.
Chevy doesn't bundle the connectors, the
which
adapters.
Seems sort of like, come on.
Yeah, I know.
Especially if you're like the second automaker to be like, sure, we'll go to NACS. Come on. So yeah, I got two adapters with my Hyundai, and you know everyone else is like, yeah, here you go, here's your adapters, you know. Whatever. And Chevy's like, no, you got to buy those. Like, come on.
Yeah, you know, I charged this thing up. Yeah, you know, right now I've got a Electron Nexus charger that they sent me to try out, and mm-hmm. it's got a J3400 connector on it. Mm-hmm. Plugged it in, started charging, no problem at all. You know, works great with that one. When I use that with our car, with our EV6, I have an adapter that I have to use with that, but otherwise, works great, straight up with NACS equipped cars.
Cool.
All right, let's carry on. So did you see Joel Fetter's story?
Fetter's story about on the drive this week. And as someone who's been pulled over and asked to step out of a car over the loudspeaker, it can be unnerving. And again, I'm very happy, you know, like Joel says, I'm happy he didn't have his kids. Cause that's terrifying for your children, especially in, you know, the now of America. So, and it makes complete sense, to be honest, because, you know, AI is not great, doesn't work correctly. And then everyone's relying on it. And the fact that, you know, police officers are not, you know, tech people, they are police officers. And the fact that it's like, well, this is just the thing that says we're just doing the thing we're supposed to do. And now Joel gets.
So maybe we should back up a little bit. And explain to everybody what we're talking about. So Joel Fetter is a friend of ours. He is the director of editorial content, I think, at The Drive. He lives in Minnesota. He lives outside of Minneapolis in Plymouth, Minnesota. And last week, he was driving a Range Rover, $155,000 Range Rover. And one of the things about a lot of the press cars that we get have manufacturer license plates on them, which typically have different numbering patterns on them than standard license plates. It's all weird,
little numbers and big numbers.
It varies from state to state. You know, Michigan, they just throw an M in the middle, you know, so you have like a two digits, an M, and then three digits. You know, California's are different. Because Jaguar Land Rover's U.S. headquarters is in New Jersey, the New Jersey manufacturer plates on there, and the Jersey manufacturer plates are like 3-4 in the standard size numbers, and then a small two-digit number in the middle, and then I think it was DTM on this one, in the larger numbers, or larger letters, the standard size letters. And, he had been driving it for several days around Minnesota, and he had gotten flagged by the Flock license plate reader cameras. So there are currently, there are currently 114,345 license plate reader cameras, mostly from Flock, that have been mapped in the U.S. We don't know exactly how many there are in total, but there's at least 114,345 that we know of, and there's a site called DFlock. So if you want to know where the Flock cameras are, if you go to dflock.org, and there'll be a link in the show notes, you can zoom in on your region and your area and see exactly where these cameras are located. And you know, if you spot one of these cameras and you can add it, you can add the information to DFlock. You can submit it there. And contrary to what the CEO of Flock says, this is not a terroristic organization, just an information site. Yeah, you know, these are not terrorists. These are just people providing information. You know, if you want to protect your privacy, you want to know where the Flock cameras are. So these are automated license plate reader cameras, and they're using AI to track all kinds of other stuff. So they're not just reading your license plate. You know, if you've got bumper stickers on your car, or, you know, I mean, it's identifying what type of vehicle it is that, you know, when it sees something, the license plate number, bumper stickers that are on your car, what kind of bumper sticker. I was looking at something this morning. Somebody posted a picture from Flock camera and had it tagged. You know, it was a Toyota Tacoma, had a Las Vegas Raiders sticker on the back, and it identified it as Las Vegas Raiders sticker, you know, on the back. You know, all kinds of other information. If there's dents on your car, it'll tag all of that information. So it's tagging all kinds of information. And when Flock saw this Range Rover driving around, it decided that it had stolen license plates on it. These manufacturer plates, you know, are typically a different configuration from most regular plates. And somewhere in the Los Angeles area, another JLR vehicle with similar license plate, but had, you know, different small digits in the middle. Instead of the 10, it had, I think it was 03, the plates had been reported as stolen. They were not.
Well, I think
fact,
it was missing. I think they were
missing.
They just lost
them.
Yeah, they
missing lost or yeah, lost or stolen. What? Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, it turns out that it had been. I think it was the plates had been removed for a photo session with the car, and you know, somebody had entered the information into Flock without those two center digits. So all it had was the 3-4 DTM. And so basically Flock was tagging every vehicle it saw across the country, and basically every JLR press vehicle that had these license plates on there were tagged and being reported as driving around with stolen license plates. And apparently, Joel had one of these. And he and his wife were running some errands, and as they were about to pull out of a parking space, the mall in Minnesota, four police cars converged on them. Now, why you need four police cars to stop one car that allegedly has stolen license plates is beyond me. I mean, you know, the overreaction of police to nonsense like this is ridiculous, but. You know, four police cars converged on him, ambushed him, told Joel and his wife to get out of the car. They were on opposite sides of the car. They were each being interviewed separately. Their stories lined up. He explained, you know, hey, I'm an automotive journalist. This is a press vehicle. It belongs to Jaguar Land Rover. I don't know anything about stolen license plates, you know, and they spent an hour interrogating him and his wife about all this before finally got. You know, before they finally let him go. And the police also warned them that you might want to not drive this car anymore, because it had been being tracked by Flock for 4 days before they finally caught up with him, because it was going in and out of regions where the Flock cameras were seeing him. And so, you know, it didn't necessarily know, you know, where he was at all times yet. But they, you know, he said, you know, you probably, you know, want to stay out of Minneapolis with this car, because, you know, the situation might have been very different there. You know, the police did not draw any guns on them. They could have. That's, you know, something that is not unheard of, unfortunately. You know, it was a ridiculous situation. And it turned out that, you know, somebody, like I said, had incorrectly entered the information into the Flock system about the license plate. So they had a bunch of different cars with, you know, that were all thought to be the same allegedly stolen license plate.
That's the craziest part about this, is that the Flock system's like, okay, we found it, and they're going to ping the local police department. But it also found the same, allegedly the same car in different parts of the country.
Yeah.
And they couldn't like figure that out. Like, it was like, okay, this car's stolen. But also it's telling other police departments in other regions that the exact same car, according to the Flock AI system, is also over here. It's also in, like, say, Nevada, you know, California. It's also in New York. It's also in Seattle. It's also in, you know, Detroit. It's also, and it was like, yeah, that's not important information.
Yeah.
maybe we should double check our data.
Yeah. When you recognize something like that, you know, in the system, it should flag that as, hey, you know, get a human to take a look at this and, you know, compare these and see what's going on. And, you know, then a human would have, you know, hopefully pretty quickly noticed the difference in the license plates. But yeah, so, you know, this is an insane story. You know, I've never had anything quite like this, although I have had an interaction in the past with police while driving a press car. Back in 2008, I had a Dodge Charger police car that Chrysler had in their press fleet at the time. It was in the press fleet, and they also used it for demos to police agencies. And so, you know, it had their police package on it, had the lights and the sirens and everything, and it was painted black and white and had a big Dodge City Police logo on the sides, on the doors. Mm-hmm. You know, so, I mean, it looked, at first glance, it looked like a genuine police car. And Technically, it was a genuine police car. It did not belong to a police agency, but it had also had stickers on the windshield and the back window said out of service.
Yeah.
And so I was driving back from an event in Detroit, and I stopped in Dearborn to get some gas, as you'll do, you know, with a 5.7 liter Hemi charger because, you know, it's not very fuel efficient. So I pulled into a gas station in Dearborn. As I pull up to the pump, a police officer pulls across in front of me and jumps out and says, why are you driving? As I get out of the car, I said, why are you driving that car? And so I'm going through the same kind of thing Joel did, explaining that I write for Autoblog. This is from the Chrysler press fleet. You know, they gave it to me, they loaned it to me for a week to evaluate it and do a review of this thing. You know, said, do the lights work? Do the sirens work? I said, yes, but I don't use them because I'm not stupid, you know, and then had to, and this was like after hours, this was like, at, you know, 5:30, 6 PM, you know, trying to call, the fleet company, the fleet manager, you know, he was out of the office. He was gone for the day, trying to call, you know, PR person at Chrysler, and, you know, to explain, you know, why I was driving this car. And, you know, she finally ended up calling her supervisor. And after about half an hour, they let me go. Yeah, you know, but it was a ridiculous situation, you know, and...
And you know what? When they have the little computers in the car, so I had a situation with the Honda Civic, that it wheels had been stolen off of it. And they called Honda. You know why? Because they put the license plate into the machine, and the machine said, oh, this belongs to Honda.
Yeah.
So they called Honda, who then called the fleet people, who then called me. So they know... Like 2 seconds, you know, do your job, look it up. Oh, this belongs to X. Instead, it's just like, I'm just going to jump out and go half cocked and just yell at people. I'm like, come on, look it up. It takes 2 seconds.
And
it's literally
and
your
one,
job.
Let me double check. Okay. So I just pulled up a picture of it. This one did not have manufacturer plates on it, it just had regular Michigan license plates on it. But
if it was if it still belonged to
yeah,
to
it would have been registered to Chrysler.
I don't think that Honda had manufacturer plates that I was driving. I think it just had regular California plates, and they still knew it belonged to Honda. The cops found out because again they called Honda, who called the fleet manager, who called me.
So you know, it's one. You know, it's a weird situation that people who do what we do, you know, might sometimes encounter. But the thing is, you know, we're seeing a lot of scenarios where just regular people are getting flagged by systems like Flock. You know, and you know, the whole country is being turned into a surveillance state. You know, we're tracking way too much information, way too many people for no good reason.
That's my big privacy paranoia. I remember 10, 12 years ago, Sausalito put up an automatic license plate reader. And I was like, well, I guess I'm not going to Sausalito. That was like my big, like, well, I guess I'm not going there if you're going to be doing that. And it was a big deal. And now that same system is just absolutely everywhere. There's one up the street from my house. If I go to the Flock, there's literally one right, you know, 5 blocks from where I live. And I'm like, that's a main road. What am I supposed to do?
And the township where I live does not have a contract with Flock. There are private businesses that do have contracts with Flock, you know, that have these cameras in their parking lots, for example. The Lowe's, that's about a mile and a half from here, has like 4 Flock cameras in their parking lot. And then across the street from that, the Meijer grocery store has 6 Flock cameras. So even if your local municipality isn't using Flock, there's a good chance that you're being captured on these cameras from they're hosted by private businesses. And there's an increasing number of cities now that are canceling their contracts with Flock. And even just this past week, Westland, Michigan, about 20 miles east of me here, just declined to renew their contract with Flock. I've seen in recent weeks, other cities, that you know, Flock wouldn't let them cancel the contract or remove the cameras. So they just went out and sent out their city crews to just put trash bags over the cameras.
Yeah, they're just bagging them up. They're like, oh, well, I mean, you have, you go, you know, you complain to your city. You say, hey, this isn't cool. This isn't a thing that, you know, we should be doing to the public. You know, there's, you know, we as individuals, we have rights. And so, yeah, that's my big thing. There was a so I had a family member who was in the hospital and they had one of those little Flock setups. And it would, if you didn't leave within a certain amount of time, it would have a like a loudspeaker. They would be like, you're on a private property. Please leave. The ridiculous part was that the hospital had like a little grassy area and they had like a little like, and people would go and you can only have so many people inside the room.
Mm-hmm.
So if a whole family would come, like they would all take turns. And so people would have like little picnics outside the hospital in the grassy area and the hospital seemed fine with it. I never saw anyone be like, oh, you can't do that. But the whole time, there's just like Flock cameras, like, please leave the area. You are in a public manner. And when I would get out to my car, like I'd have to talk to doctors and stuff. And so I would take notes and then I would send those notes to like other family members to keep them updated. So I'd sit in the car and I sit down, I gather my thoughts and I start texting people. And while I'm in the car, please leave the area. You are in a private way. Yeah. I was just like, what are you doing? What's even going on? Like, wait, like one person, like, you know what? We need heightened security for the hospital parking lot. And while everyone else in the place is like, you know, people go out to their cars and, you know, maybe they're grieving or maybe they're contacting other people or maybe they're kind of like getting ready to go inside. And some people are hanging out and picnicking and, you know, we only allow two people in at a time. So we can't have all these people up there. So they're taking turns. But like one person was like, we know what we need. We need a camera that takes up an entire parking space and then yells at people who are having a bad day, to be honest.
Yeah. So like I said, if you want to see where the cameras are around you, go to deflock.org. All right.
Please leave the area.
But don't leave this area right now where you are.
Yeah,
right,
please
now.
Say, please stick around for more wheelbarrows.
All right. Car loans. Jalopnik had a piece this week. Let's see. Almost, 23.9% of new car buyers are now opting for car loans of 84 months or more.
Oof.
It came from Edmunds initially from their data. So the average car loan is now $44,156. That's how much people are financing on average. Because prices are going up and customers have less money to put down on a down payment. Because everything else is getting more expensive too.
Yeah.
The $5,800 down payment is down $600 from the second quarter of 2025. And this is an issue. I mean, we talked about it before. You know, it's not just the car prices themselves, but it's also the interest rates, because interest rates have remained stubbornly high. That's an issue for consumers. And, you know, there's, you know, a lot fewer people that can afford to buy a new car now. And that's a problem, you know, because, you know, okay, you get pushed to the used car market, but if there's fewer people buying new cars, that means there's going to be a smaller population of used cars to choose from in the coming years. And we're already seeing that. And used car prices are going up as well.
Yeah. It snowballs because, you know, gas is more expensive. You're like, well, you know, my car now gets like 10 miles a gallon because it's like 20 years old. So maybe I should get a new car. But then you look at the new car prices and you look, oh my gosh, how much is this? Oh, okay. So I don't have enough money because I'm paying more for everything else for a down payment. So now I have to get this really, really long loan in order to afford my monthly payments. But in the long run, you're paying way more money because the interest rates are so high and your loan is so, you know, long, 7 years. I mean, by the time you get to like year four, you're probably already underwater on that car. I mean, you're underwater as soon as you walk out.
Year two, even year one or year two, you're probably underwater. You know, so, you know, and the bad thing about that is if something happens, you know, if your car gets stolen or you get into a crash or something, typical car insurance pays you, you know, what the replacement value of that car or pays you what the market value of that car is, not necessarily what the replacement value is. So, you know, if you've got a 2 or 3 year old used car and you owe, you know, $35,000 on it, but the value of it is only say $25,000 or $30,000, you know, then that's what the insurance company is going to pay you. Now you're, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 in the hole, and you got to go buy a replacement vehicle, and you're not getting enough money from the insurance to pay for another car.
Yeah. So it's. Yeah. Yeah. It's not great. Things aren't great, people.
So go buy a Nissan Kicks or a Chevy Trax instead of something more expensive. Yeah. Or a Hyundai Venue. Yeah.
Or a Hyundai Venue. I mean, I think it's, I mean, we all want the new shiny, you know, oh, this is really cool. This is really nice. But at the end of the day, getting the cheap car. I mean, you know, again, I think we all know I really like the Slate. I can only afford the Slate because I'm selling my BRZ. That's it. And then, you know, and then I can use that towards buying the vehicle. That's how I can afford it. I'm not going to get another, you know, X amount of year loan for, you know, with $5,000 down. That's like, no, I'm not going to do that.
All right. Moving on.
It's a real downer today. We got
yeah. let's see. A Swedish organization did some testing. They did this a couple of years ago, where they ran a bunch of tests to look at how long it takes, you know, how long it takes to do a bunch of typical tasks with cars that have touchscreens in them. And their baseline was a 2005 Volvo V70, where most of the stuff is obviously physical controls. And so they measure the time that it takes to do each of those tasks while you're driving the car at 68 miles an hour, so at highway speeds. And in the V70, it took, you know, for all the different tasks combined, took 300 meters to do it, which is about so 300 meters. The average over all the different vehicles they tested was 813 meters. All of the newer cars that had all these touchscreens in them all took a lot longer to do these tasks, like turn signals and, you know, changing temperature and a variety of other tasks that are commonly done while you're driving. Mm-hmm. The Mazda CX-60 was actually the worst of all the vehicles this year. Took 1,137 meters to do this stuff.
It's
so
not great.
You're talking, you know, about 3/4 of a mile for all these tasks combined. You know that you're not, and this is the time that you're looking away from the road in order to execute these tasks. Mercedes CLA 1,116 meters. Toyota Corolla Cross 1,024, and, you know, then went down from there. Kia EV3 was about 812. Tesla Model Y was actually better than I expected. They've made some changes in their interface design, but it still took 608 meters, which is more than mm-hmm. double what the V70 took. So, stop putting everything into the touchscreens. You know,
stop it. Yeah, exactly. Put more, you know, that's why I like the Chevy Trax.
Yeah.
It's got all the knobs and I don't have to I need to change the temperature. And then I hit a bump and my finger moves. So then I have to readjust my finger or I have to brace it on something. And during that thing, I'm not looking at the road. I'm looking at a screen. That's not how this should work. That's not how it should work at all. That's how none of this should work like this.
Yeah.
Everyone was like, hey, let's put screens in everything. I'm like, yeah, there's things for screens, but also put some buttons back. put it back.
Okay, let's see. Some good news.
Yay!
For farmers.
Yay!
The John Deere, which has been fighting right to repair for many, many years. They've been at the heart of the whole right to repair argument for probably a decade or more, because they started putting all these electronics in their tractors and making it, you know, largely impossible for farmers to repair their own tractors, or, you know, even for, you know, local mechanics, local technicians to come out to a farm and repair the tractor. Basically, you had to get your service done by official John Deere technicians. And last year, you know, there was a lawsuit that got settled. But, you know, it was, you know, the settlement was kind of ridiculous. I think John Deere agreed to pay $99 million, which $79 million was left over after legal fees, split between 200,000 farmers. They got $395 a piece.
Womp, womp.
Yeah. Amazingly enough, the Federal Trade Commission did not give up. You know, this was a case that was started under the previous administration, under Lina Khan, when she was chair of the Federal Trade Commission. They have now got a settlement with John Deere, where, you know, they have to provide tools and like diagnostic tools and parts and everything at fair and reasonable prices to anybody that wants to buy them. And unlike the legal settlement last year, which left fair and reasonable very open ended, this deal, it's much more constrained. And so now, you know, they have defined what the pricing is going to be for all this stuff. And so John Deere, you know, is basically going to have to sell parts and sell diagnostic tools at reasonable prices to farmers, or, you know, to local repair people that can support these tractors going forward. So good news for them.
Yeah, and it's good news for everyone because it sets a precedent for this sort of, you know, right to repair. You know, I think it's, if you have the means, you know, and for, you know, there are some, you know, I don't want you, don't try to repair like your EV battery, but
yeah,
you know, there should,
unless you're a trained technician trained to do that sort of thing. You know, if you work at a dealership or a shop and you've been trained in how to handle high voltage batteries, then, you know, go ahead, you know, work on your own EV. But for all the rest of us, let the professionals do it.
But there's a lot of things that, you know, that I feel like, I remember when I had my Mini, I remember getting angry every time I had to work on it. Like, you're like, oh, I need to replace a headlight. Oh, I have to buy, you know, a special, you know, there's a Torx instead of a regular, you know, it was a Torx screw. I'm like, and I had the tool, but I was just like, if I'm a regular person with just like the regular, you know, set of tools, I'm not going to have that. And then for the spark plugs, they use the 12-point spark plugs. So you couldn't use a regular, you know, spark plug.
The 12-point spark plugs on the Mini?
Yeah. So I had to go out. And so you had to go to Mini's site, and it was like $80. I'm like, nope. And I went to Lowe's, and it was like $15. But yeah. I was so angry that entire day, because it's just one more thing where, like, well, you should just take it into the dealership. Just bring it into the dealership and do it, and, you know, we'll fix it for you. And, you know, all of that is leading to, like, getting people to not fix their own vehicles, have someone else in a very sly way, or spending an insane amount of money for something you can get at Lowe's for like $50 cheaper. And I was just like, every time I had to do something on that car, I would just get angry at BMW for their sort of like, oh yeah, you got to buy a special tool for this. And which all those things, none of those things. I bought like just the regular, you know, socket sized spark plugs for that car. I was like, nope, I'm not getting your stupid 12. No.
Just out of spite.
Just out of spite. Just like the next person who gets his car, you know, the next person who got that car, they, you know, they could just get their regular old, you know, spark plug socket with the little rubber thing inside and change the spark plugs and have a very nice day. As opposed to me, who was like just in there, like trying to get it to seat. And I'm like, what is going on? And then finally I take a light note. I'm like, what the hell is this?
I mean, why would you even put 12 point hex, or, well, not, I guess a dodecagram, whatever, a 12 point thing on a spark plug, you know, because the last thing you want is your socket slipping on it. And the more points you have on there, the more likelihood you're going to get something wrong and strip it. You know, just make it simple.
It was very, you know, so they, the Mini also had, it had like a plastic, drain plug.
Uh-huh.
So instead of the metal one, so the local, I don't change my own oil. I'll swap an engine before I'll change my own oil. It's 'cause I'm just like, this is not worth my time for the amount of money I'm saving. So I would take it to the local like Jiffy Lube, and the dudes that came out, like, hey, so you have the plastic and we won't change those because they strip real easy because it's plastic. And then we have to wait because we have to go find one. And we have to go to the dealership. We have to bring it back. So you should just take it to the dealership. So I was like, fine. So I took it. It ended up being cheaper at the dealership and they washed my car. But the idea that I was forced to go to the dealership still never sat well with me.
Yeah. All right. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is finally starting to make some moves when it comes to automated vehicles.
Listen, they wrote a letter.
Well, hey, you got to start somewhere.
Which is the most they've done in years.
Yeah. So, in case you haven't been following the, you know, what's been going on with robo-taxis of late, you know, as we get more and more of these things on the road, you know, and Waymo's got close to 4,000 of these things now in operation across, I think, you know, between, they've got like 10 cities in normal commercial operation. They got four more starting in the next few weeks, or they're operating now with employees and soon opening up to the public. And by the end of this year, I think they're targeting about 20 cities. So they've got about 4,000 robo taxis out there on the road. And you got, you know, a few dozen Teslas, and you got some Zooks robo taxis and various others. The more of these you get out there, the more problems you're going to encounter. And one of those problems is when a robo-taxi encounters an emergency responder, whether it's police, firefighters, paramedics, you know, when there's nobody in the driver's seat, you know, how do the emergency responders, you know, get these vehicles to move out of the way? You know, when a human is driving a vehicle and police are, you know, directing traffic, you know, around a crash or something like that, or there's firefighters, you know, they can stand out there, wave their hand, you know, give them nonverbal communications, go tap on the window and say, go that way, you know, whatever. And that's a little bit harder when there's nobody in the driver's seat. And these vehicles don't all respond in the same way. And so NHTSA sent out a letter to all these different companies and said, you got until the end of the month. We're going to start bringing you all in for some calls to figure this out and try to come up with some standards for how these vehicles should interoperate with emergency responders.
I've been telling people, whenever people are like, well, self-driving cars, I'm like, okay, here's how the problem with self-driving. And I always bring up the person in the street waving you on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as a human, because you have a lived experience, you understand, oh, they want me to go. They're pointing, they're doing whatever. The car doesn't know what that is. They just, all they see is human. Block, little human that's been tagged. They know what it is.
Machine learning has told them. Try not to hit that block.
Don't hit that human. Yeah, and so, you know, and when these things get bunched up in places, or they, like, who do you get in? Do you drive it? Like, are you making first responders drive these cars, forcefully taking over the car? Like, what do you do?
In some cases, that's what's happened with some of the Waymos, because the Waymos all still have steering wheels and pedals. But, you know, now, Zooks. You know, you got the Zooks robo-taxis. Tesla is testing their cyber cabs with no wheels and pedals in there. NHTSA has even said, you know, they're going to change the rules. They put out a notice of proposed rulemaking to allow the companies to pull out the pedals. You know, what do you do when there are no controls for a police officer or a firefighter to get in and move the vehicle?
And they're blocking, you know, access to events.
Yeah.
You know, they're blocking, you know, one firefighter, one truck shows up, others have to show up But now they're being blocked by Waymos. They're being blocked by these self-driving vehicles. And it's a, you know, again, the idea we're allowing beta testing on public roads without any sort of real hardcore regulatory framework. And, you know, and these are not edge cases. Like, things happen all the time with emergency vehicles. Mm-hmm. That's literally, yeah, that's how the world works, you know. And so if these vehicles can't figure that out, then, you know, maybe you shouldn't have your vehicle on the road. If you can't do the basic get out of the way.
Yeah.
And you've failed is essentially what I'm saying. You have failed as a company if your car does not know how to get out of the way of first responders.
All right. Let's see next. Oh, there's a new cheap car available now for sale in the U.S. I mean, it's cheap. It's sort of a car.
It's like a whiff of a car.
Yeah. It's the Fiat Topolino, which is a vehicle that's actually been around for a few years in Europe. They've sold it as the Citroën AMI. They actually were using them for a while. Free2Move, which is a mobility subsidiary of Stellantis, was operating a car-sharing service in D.C. using these vehicles for a while. I don't know if they still are. But you can go buy your own Topolino now. It's a tiny little vehicle. In Europe, it's what's known as it's classified as a quadricycle. So these are vehicles that have a maximum top speed. You know, they have a body, but you don't necessarily need a full blown driver's license to operate one of these, because these, you know, the Topolino is limited to 19 miles an hour, I think.
You'll see kids driving these. You'll be driving along, and all of a sudden you'll come up behind a vehicle that's going like 20 kilometers at night.
Well, really in an urban area, 20 miles an hour is fine.
Yeah, you're not going.
It's got an electric range of just 46 miles, but it's tiny. You can park it pretty much anywhere, and they're available now it's $13,995 is the sticker price, but then I think with delivery, I think it's about $15,000.
Yeah,
with delivery. And they have versions with straps instead of doors.
Yeah, it's a strap and then like one of those cloth sunroofs. I forget what they're called. The you know what they're called. I want a car with ropes for door. It's just a rope. A car with ropes for doors, and you can get, so the top speed is 19, but they'll make it 25 for free, but that's not going to happen till later. But you can just, like, if you're driving around town, I need to go to the Trader Joe's, I need to go do a couple things. I can see these, like, especially like in a senior community, like my in-laws live in like a little gated, it's like a low level prison for old people, but they live in a gated community. And they all drive golf carts everywhere.
Yeah.
And
this is basically a fancier golf cart.
Yeah. And golf carts are expensive.
Yeah.
This
is
only like a few grand more than a new golf cart.
Yeah.
Like, of a regular golf cart. Like, if you get like a fancier one with four seats, those are like about the same price. This only has two seats, so it's just you and your friend. But I don't know. I like the door. It's just cute. You're going to have the cutest golf cart in the retirement community.
Yeah.
I wonder if they'll let you drive it on the golf course.
And, you know, it's classified as a low-speed electric vehicle, and that, you know, those have different regulations than conventional cars. The limit for those is 25 miles an hour on most U.S. roads. So, yeah. A bunch of new safety regulations have gone into effect this week in Europe. These were first proposed a couple of years ago, and they took full effect on 7th of July, 2026. So, you know, this past week. Any newly homologated vehicles have to meet all these requirements, and then other vehicles over the next couple of years will also have to meet them. So any new vehicles that are launched have to include advanced emergency braking systems that detect pedestrians and cyclists. That's a good thing. Advanced driver distraction warning to keep drivers focused. So this is a driver monitor system. So kind of like what we've seen on on cars with hands-free systems.
Or Subarus.
Or actually a bunch of Hyundais and Kias have them as well. With those, if you look away from the road for more than 3.5 seconds, it's got to start giving you alerts and eventually bring the car to a stop. Improved forward vision requirements. An interesting one is new tests for worn tires to ensure safer performance. So, typically the official, tire performance ratings, are based on brand new tires with full tread depth. What this new regulation says is that when a tire is worn down to 1.6 millimeters tread depth, which is the legal limit, it still has to exhibit 80% of its wet weather braking performance that it had when it was brand new.
Cool.
So, this is really more on tire makers right now, to make sure that their tires, even when they're down to their wear bars, still have, 80% of their wet braking performance. But this is the only one that's also going to affect used cars, because as people replace their older tires, they're going to get new tires that meet these requirements. And so that'll be safer for everybody. One of the things that they said, I was reading some of the documentation, is this will also help prevent some premature replacement of tires. People were replacing them before they were, down to the wear bars, just because the wet performance had degraded so much that, they couldn't really drive with them. So this will keep tires on the road longer, still maintain a decent level of safety.
Cool. Yeah. I think the advanced driver distraction warning system, the sort of in-car, I know that even Bosch has talked about those issues with, everyone has a different face. Everyone has different, resting eyelid situation. Mm-hmm. So that's where, you get into some weirdness with that thing where, some people are going to have, false, like you're not paying attention to the road when they really are.
Well, this is where, the software for these things is getting more advanced, so that it's modeling each driver that uses the vehicle, to figure out what is the baseline for this particular driver. Yeah. So that, it knows when there's a variation from that baseline. That one part of the regulation, the European regulation, for that is that the systems must be all closed loop in the vehicle. So it can't, it's not allowed to send any of that information outside of the vehicle.
And that's the most important part, because I don't need, what my face looks like being sent to somebody.
Yeah.
That's not
except for
cool.
All the people on the internet.
Again, Europe has some pretty, has way better privacy regulations for their people versus us.
just to say that they have privacy regulations makes it better than the US. So.
Yeah. Well, California has good stuff.
Yeah. California's okay.
But the rest of y'all, sorry.
MG, if you remember MG when they made little sports cars, little roadsters, the brand is still around, but since the early 2000s, it's been owned by SAIC, Shanghai Automotive Industries Company, which, based on that, as you might guess, it's owned by the Chinese now. MG brand has continued to sell cars in China and in Europe and other countries as well, but obviously not here. And a lot of them, are cars, mostly cars and crossovers. They have one sports car, the Cyberster, which is an electric roadster. But they this week at the Goodwood Festival of Speed, they showed a concept called the What is it called? The MG Go concept, which is meant to be kind of a modern take on the old MGB GT. Doesn't really look much like the MGB GT, but it's basically an electric hot hatch.
Yeah, it looks cool.
Yeah.
I
like
it.
The design a lot.
I mean, we won't get it, but I dig it. This looks really cool. It looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Go. It's got and the Go has like a little exclamation point.
There it is. There's like the MG Go.
Like the Go team, the band from the,
oh yeah,
I guess early 2000s.
So probably people in Europe will get this in, you know, a year or so, and in China.
And we'll just like stare at them from afar. We're like, well, we got other things.
Yeah. we got Hellcats here.
We got Hellcats. We got that going for us. You know, yeah. We got Hellcats.
Lexus, Toyota was also at Goodwood this week. They had the GR-GT and the GR-GT3, which is their new GT3 race car that's coming next year's season. And they also brought out the new Lexus LFA. So we saw the LFA at the Japan Mobility Show in Tokyo in October. And this is the first time that it's been seen in motion. The LFA shares its basic architecture with the GR-GT, but where the GR-GT has a twin-turbo V8 and a hybrid, the LFA is all electric. And so they had these three cars, the GR-GT, the GT3, and the LFA, running up the hill at Goodwood this week. And apparently, this is going to be the first Toyota vehicle to actually use solid-state batteries.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. And, you know, there's not, you know, obviously not going to be very many of these built. It's going to be a very low-volume car because it's going to be very expensive. But it'll be the first one with solid state. And, you know, they're saying that they want to win over EV skeptics with the feel of a V10. They don't really give any details on what exactly that means. But, you know, they, you know, presumably it's going to make some noise and, you know, do some simulated shifting stuff. But we'll see.
Listen, the solid state, you know, it's going to have to go into expensive vehicles for cars first, probably, because it gives you the opportunity to work on the technology, get into production, and figure out your little issues and, you know, a low, you know, even, you know, the donut people. Again, they were only making 300 of those bikes.
Yeah.
It wasn't like they're making, people were like, I can't believe there's no way. I'm like, they're not making 10,000 motorcycles, guys. They're making 300, maybe. So, yeah, same thing.
And
with
maybe
this.
None we're at just, all.
Yeah, and maybe none at all. We're still like, you know, they keep doing their little like, hey, I do not believe this, which is pretty funny. their website to sort of debunk everyone who's going after them. But you know, with this, you know, it's the same sort of thing. You know, you're making short run. You're proving that the technology works, and you know the people who buy this are going to be like, I got this thing. I got the first solid state battery, and I think some of them are going to accept the fact that like, hey, we might, you know, we're, you know, it's going to be expensive, and you know, we're probably going to have to, you know, maybe we'll have to swap your battery, or you know, after so long. That's the issue with solid states, is that they don't last. Their life cycle isn't as long. It has nothing to do with charging, discharging. It has to do with during charging, discharging. It creates things called dendrites, which cause short circuits, which kills the lifetime of the battery. And that's what everyone's trying to fix.
All right. And then we got one final story for this week, which is a new bill in New Jersey related to automated vehicles and robo-taxis. And so, you know, there's not a lot in terms of regulation around automated vehicles, safety regulation around automated vehicles in the United States. We don't have anything at a federal level. There's no specific regulations that govern federal motor vehicle safety standards that govern them. But this bill in New Jersey would require companies seeking to operate fully autonomous vehicles in New Jersey to use cameras plus two other sensing technologies. And right now, you know, those two technologies that you typically find on these vehicles is radar and LiDAR. So, you know, but it doesn't have to be those. You know, if you can come up with something else, like there's a company called Terradar that's doing a terahertz sensor that is supposed to give you most of the benefit of LiDAR, but closer to the cost of radar. That could be used, or you know,
echolocation, like you could just shove bats on your car.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's all kinds of ways you could do it. You know, strap a few bats to around the perimeter of the car. The key thing is there, you have to have at least three different sensing technologies for a fully automated vehicle. For the most part, this really only affects Tesla, because Tesla insists that they can do this with just cameras.
Well, you know what I like on the road? Redundancy for my robots.
Yes.
I don't care what Tesla says. I don't care what Tesla, oh, you know, well, we could just do it with the cameras, which A, not true. You're driving around where there's children and people and bicyclists and other cars, but mostly pedestrians. And I would like as many sensors as possible. I want redundancy. That's the whole point of this, is redundancy. Tesla had this big event once years ago where they're talking about how their computer system, we have redundancies. I'm like, you can't sit there and talk about redundancy when you refuse to use LiDAR and radar. Come on.
And I mean, they used to have a radar sensor. They didn't even have surround radar. They just had a single radar sensor, and they got rid of that. And they got rid of their ultrasonic sensors, which were basically useless anyway for automated driving. But they even got rid of those.
Beep, beep, beep. That's when, you know, when you're backing up and you're trying to park,
those
and then also the car
button-looking things on your bumpers.
Those are ultrasonic.
Yeah.
Those
little
are the bats.
Sonar sensors.
Those are the bats. Never mind.
One ping only.
One ping only. Anyway, Tesla. If Tesla wants to get into this business, then Tesla needs to up its game.
Mm-hmm.
Period. I understand why New Jersey wants there to be redundant systems, because you are, you know, giant hunks of metal and plastic and glass, you know, flying down the road at 60 miles an hour. Well, most of these are in town, so 35, 40 miles an hour. Doesn't matter.
A pedestrian at 35 miles an hour, still going to do a lot of damage.
Yeah. It's just do the redundancy thing. Make it safer. The safer you can make it, the better it is.
Yeah. The bill's sponsor, Senator Andrew Zwicker, said, this is not anti-Tesla. I'm pro-New Jersey safety.
So that's a smart
safety's
thing.
Good.
Yeah.
All right. So that's it for the stories. We did get one email from Bob Hastings, relating to something we talked about last week, which is the new California incentives. There was one detail that we missed out of there in that discussion. It says, not mentioned when you talked about the new California EV rebate is the maximum price exception. There is no maximum vehicle price for California-based manufacturers to qualify for the rebate.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, for any vehicle from a company that's not based in California, you know, let's say Ford or General Motors or Hyundai, new vehicles have to be priced less than $50,000 and used has to be under $25,000. But if the company is based in California, is headquartered in California, then there is no price cap. So you can get the rebate on, you know, $150,000 Tesla or Lucid Air Grand Touring. Or $125,000, Rivian R1 quad,
which is fine, I guess.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, there's not many people buying those anyway, so whatever. But of course, you know, since Tesla moved their headquarters from Palo Alto to Texas, they don't get the
But also, the two car makers that are in California are both pretty, you know, Lucid is, you know, that's a premium automaker, and Rivian is the Patagonia of EVs. So it's also a premium automaker. So both of those are expensive vehicles. So people are buying those like, oh, I guess I got $3,500 off. Cool.
I mean, if you can afford one of those vehicles, you know, you're probably fine. Shouldn't be getting a rebate.
You don't need this. I mean, you'll do it anyway.
Chances are at this point, if you're buying one of those vehicles, it's probably not your first EV anyway, so you still wouldn't qualify.
Yeah.
So it's only for first-time EV buyers.
Yeah.
All right. That's it for this week. If you got questions, comments, send them to us at feedback@wheelbearings.media. We'd love to hear from you. And we will talk to you all next time. Bye.
Bye.